Welcome to Industry Misinterpretations, episode 188, with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This week, I interviewed Michael about Web Velocity 1.1, which is in late alpha right now and going into beta shortly. If you're interested in downloading that once we do go into beta, please send me an email at jrobertson, J-R-O-B-E-R-T-S-O-N, at syncom.com. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group of Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. This is James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Michael Lucas Smith, one of the lead engineers on our Small Talk development products.
I am barely here. I only just...
It is early in the morning out there on the West Coast. 10 a.m. is pretty early for those folks.
I was up pretty late. trying to port Seaside.
How's that going, by the way? Since that does relate to our topic, we're going to talk about Web Velocity 1.1, but since Web Velocity 1.1 is built on the top of Seaside, let's start with that. How's the port of 3.0 going?
Good. Well, it's 3.0 Alpha 5. We're currently on Alpha 4. Technically, it's Alpha 6, but Alpha 6 isn't really released yet. But all of these alphas are really close to the final thing anyway.
Well, how close to the final thing are they? I mean, there's a difference between alpha and beta. If they're still in alphas, they obviously haven't gone beta yet.
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, guys, what are you guys doing? People are using it already. I mean, production sites.
And there's a downloadable Faro image with it, too, now.
Yeah, I mean, not many people are hitting bugs or anything with it. And the bugs, when they are found, get fixed very quickly. So it's not like you couldn't have a final version and then start putting out fixes for the final version, right?
So pretty much it'll be 3.0 when somebody decides to pull the switch and call it 3.0.
Pretty much.
So what's going on with the port to VisualWorks and Object Studio? What's are there any holdups? I know you said you were up late last night working on that.
Time is of the essence. The VisualWorks and Object Studio freezes are in effect, and Web Velocity too. So I've got to get this in before dispensation period is over and we go gold, right?
Which also puts a limit on what rev of Seaside you can put in. If we get too far along the way and they decide to call something gold, and it could actually miss that window.
Yep. So we're kind of right at the edge of everything right now.
Of course, the funny part of that is that we were on the edge last, or we thought we were on the edge last time. If you recall, everybody kind of thought that what was then being called Seaside 2.9 would be out real soon now, after or right around the time VisualWorks 7.7 and Object Studio 8.2 shipped. And that didn't happen. Instead, they renamed it 3.0 and kept plowing forward.
Yeah. So what's holding it up is... all my other work. Actually, Julian now kind of understands this a bit better. Julian Fitzell of Seaside fame. A colleague of mine now, he works for European Syncom, doing various projects and sales and things. And he's been alpha testing Web Velocity 1.1 and putting it in the hands of various people to get some feedback. And he discovered that debugging broken tests didn't work.
Debugging what didn't work?
Broken tests.
Right, okay. That was that email that I saw come through. So that was for 1.1, that wasn't for 1.0? The email he sent through with feedback from a bunch of people he'd been exposing Web Velocity to.
Oh, yeah, it's 1.1, but this wasn't on that list. This was something he discovered this week.
Okay. So he's just... So anyway, go ahead.
So, yeah, he's trying out 1.1, finding some edge cases of here and there, things that he likes, doesn't like, getting in the hands of people to see what their response is. It's been very positive. So the kind of balancing act is, you know, I've got to release 1.1. And 1.1 doesn't, and Visual Works, Web Velocity, Objects GU, don't necessarily need the absolute latest CSide, although that's highly desirable. So, you know, I if I got to fix a bug to do with test cases not being able to be debugged, then that pushes back the port of CSide a little bit more. So it's literally just a matter of time.
Of course, you have infinite amounts of time, though, right?
Well, not according to the latest galactic models of how the universe works.
Okay, so why don't you give us a rundown, then let's move back a few steps and let's get a rundown on what's changed from Web Velocity 1.0 to Web Velocity 1.1.
Sorry, I was blowing my nose. You'll have to tell me in a sec after I can hear again. This is the machinations of still waking up.
So the question is, why don't you give us a rundown on what the big changes have been from Web Velocity 1.0, which was the first release, to what's out coming out now, Web Velocity 1.1?
Visually, it's quite a big upgrade. I mean, 1.0 was absolute bare minimum that we could do to get it out the door working. And there were a few bells and whistles here and there. You know, we had color syntax highlighting as you programmed. But all in all, it was a fairly bland-looking thing. That's actually kind of true of 1.12, but we've spiced it up a fair bit. There's a heap of interactivity in 1.1. The first thing you'll notice when you fire this thing up is that the whole section of the right-hand side of the screen is devoted to tools that are not that are supplementary to the job you're doing at any particular moment.
So they're context aware, in other words.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I mean, the front page is something that we really wanted to rewrite, but didn't have time to do in 1.1. So it's the same as 1.0 in essence. Basically, you have access to source code repositories, and you see what's loaded in your image and what's available in the repository. That works pretty well. It doesn't scale when you want to do the entire image, which is why that's what we wanted to do, is to represent the entire image. But, you know, we're okay with representing the applications for now. And on the right-hand side, you have tools for doing searches of the whole image and tools for seeing all the processes. You can click on a process and it'll debug it for you. Just a word of warning. Don't click on the process that serves up pages.
I hear that.
I'm going to need that one to be running.
Yeah, you don't want to do brain surgery while you're in the middle of the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's one other big change I should mention at this point is that with 1.0, you had that little console window coming up where you could, if you wanted to, you could bail back to the standard VisualWorks development tools. And that's probably the single biggest noticeable change right off the bat is that you don't have that console window anymore.
The GUI, right? The whole thing is headless now.
Right. You don't have the client GUI console window anymore, where you could spin up a browser or other tools if you really wanted to. It's completely running in the browser now. You don't have access to any of the other stuff.
Right. One of the deliverables that we'll have with this is, so we've got the Windows installer, the various Linux installers, the Mac DMG. We'll also have an Amazon EC2 image that you can upload to your instance and have Web Velocity running immediately.
And what will be included in that instance? I mean, you obviously have Web Velocity, but I guess you'd have SQLite ready to go. What, anything else going to be in that image?
Possibly Postgres. It's hard to say whether we're going to include that. I mean, in the first cut of this, we included Postgres, but now you can just use SQLite, and you can also use Amazon RDS. So it's more a matter of, well, if you've already got two good databases sitting there that you can use off the bat, if somebody wants to use Postgres, that's sort of their prerogative, right?
So they should take the time to install it, in other words. So right out of the box, though, you're going to have an EC2 ready-to-install image that that'll have access to either to SQLite, which you can use as your database. I mean, in 1.0, you could use it. You had to use it as your repository. Well, you didn't have to, but it was your default personal repository. But you couldn't really use it as a database for an application. And that's changed in 1.1. You can use SQLite as a back-end database for your application at this point.
Yeah, SQLite's really neat. I mean, you basically, the database name is a file name. So every application, you just give it a different file name, a file name named after your application.db or something like that. And that's it. You know, you say, recreate your tables, and tables get recreated, and you're up and running. And it's very performant.
Oh, I know. As far as setting up even a, if you go back to VisualWorks, setting up a personal store repository using SQLite is trivial. It's so much easier than the way it used to be, where you had to set up an Oracle or a Postgres or some other database, and typically that meant a whole bunch of configuration work that you may or may not know how to do, especially if you weren't on Windows, where the installer tends to do all that stuff for you. On any other platform, it tended to be a little bit of work in the weeds. With SQLite, it's just completely trivial to use it either in WebVelocity or VisualWorks or any other thing. I mean, there's, if you really want to know more about SQLite, I should probably recommend you to one of the old Floss Weekly podcasts. Randall interviewed the guy behind that, and that's actually one of the cooler interviews they did, I think. But you mentioned the RDS stuff too, so why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Right, so Amazon RDS is their relational database. I guess the S stands for service. Don't know why they didn't call it RDC.
I think it's service, yeah. I think they have everything as service. This service, that service, the other service, yeah.
It's MySQL, and it's unabashedly exactly MySQL. There is absolutely nothing special going on there at all. They configure it all for you. You basically just say, I want one, and up it comes. You grab the key and details, and then you fill in the MySQL database connection in WebVelocity to the details that they provide you on the RDS page, and that's it. It connects, and you can recreate your tables, and away you go.
So that means from the standpoint of deployment, getting a WebVelocity 1.1 application up in both in terms of test, in terms of just test and development and deployment, at this point you could get 1.1, well, not at this point, once it ships, you'd be able to get 1.1, do all your testing locally using, say, something like SQLite, and then do some more robust testing against an RDS instance that you presumably had set up. And once you were happy with all that, you could just take that pre-built EC2 image that you talked about, toss that on Amazon with your application, and you'd be ready to go.
It gets a little bit better than that, actually.
Okay.
I mean,
and now a short break for David Buck's Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbaron Design Minute. It's easy doing software development when you're the only developer. It's when you have a team of developers that things start getting tricky. You want the developers to be able to work in parallel, but there's a chance that they'll step on each other's toes. Some development shops try to avoid this by forcing the submits to the version control library to be sequential. Whoever published first doesn't have to do any additional work. If someone publishes afterward, they have to notice that you've published and merged their code with your changes. I usually find that the better way is for each developer to create a branch from the main development stream, then have an integrator merge these changes together later. I have two tips for doing this effectively. First, use a good tool to help you. Second, integrate frequently. The longer you wait to integrate the code, the harder it will be to do so. This has been the Cimbaron Design Minute. Cimbaron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbaron.com or email info@cimbaron.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
Because Amazon recently added Amazon load balancing. So you can actually, so you've got the Amazon RDS instance as your database, which is now scaled. And then your application, not scaled, so you put that up on your instance with your with the parcels, the deployed details and configuration files, and start up multiple of those instances. And then you can basically suspend some of them and in the state ready to run and set up the load balancer on top of it. And as required, it'll fire up instances and it puts a cookie on the remote person's browser to keep track of which session they're connected to, which instance they're connected to.
So you've got session affinity out of the box, in other words.
Yeah, you've got load balancing for your application and a scalable database all handled by Amazon, with basically no programming, just configuration.
So from the standpoint of just sketching out a little scenario, then what you could do is you could go to some place like GoDaddy, get yourself a domain, set up some VPS of your own on one of these various services that are out there. What's the one you were toying around with recently that was fairly cheap?
Ramhost.
Yeah, so you get one of something.
I love those guys. They're awesome.
Right. So you could get something like that, and it's like what it is. It's like $5 or $10 a month, really cheap. And you could set that up and have it working. And if you actually got to the point where you thought it was having scalability problems, that you really needed load balancing and you didn't want to have to build all that infrastructure yourself, you could just move yourself over to Amazon and get all that stuff for free. Well, not for free. You have to pay Amazon for it, obviously, but for free in terms of infrastructure, I mean.
Amazon does cost you money.
Right. No, the free part I meant was the infrastructure piece. You don't have to actually build any of that stuff. You have to pay for usage of it, obviously, but you don't have to actually build any of it. It's just sitting there ready for you.
Right. So medium-sized businesses, of which the majority are, have a steady income and need to spend money on their IT infrastructure anyway, can do very well with Amazon. Very well. And of course, Amazon would also argue that large businesses should also use their services because they themselves use them. And Amazon is huge. So that's also a potential option there. But often large organizations already have some sort of infrastructure set up. So it's a hard sell sometimes.
Yeah. But I mean, for anybody that's new or growing, I don't know. I cannot see the point of investing in a lot of hardware at this point when you've got inexpensive VPS services and Amazon out there. I mean, it's just, why invest in the hardware when you can pay somebody else to do all that stuff for you?
That's true.
So, okay, so that's kind of the biggest interesting thing to me about the next version of WebVelocity is that you get the cloud-ready services from Amazon, and you get RDS and SQLite out of the box, which makes that a whole lot easier to deal with. What else is new from the standpoint of the way it's going to look and feel as far as your development standpoint goes? You mentioned the tools, the context-aware tools that are on the right-hand side of the screen. The editing is different also. In 1.0, and especially with the newer versions of Chrome and Firefox, 1.0 now can be a little quirky because on a past podcast we've talked about this. You defined the editing in 1.0 as kind of an elegant hack. That's changed in 1.1, right?
Yeah, it's a huge, huge upgrade. It's there are a lot of websites out there that are swapping from Flash to HTML5 right now.
Oh, the numbers are actually fairly astonishing. I did a post a couple of weeks ago where somebody mentioned that the numbers in the course of 1 year, the numbers have flipped from, in terms of video being served, it's gone from 2/3 of video being served being Flash and 1/3 being everything else to just turning completely around.
Well, it's not just video, but it's other things too, like rendering graphics. And so we built the new text editor using the HTML canvas to do all our drawing. And it works incredibly well. There is a project that was kicked off by Mozilla to make a kind of a text editor using canvas. I can't remember what it was called now. And this is sort of the inspiration of, well, if they can do it, well, we can do it. And they went overboard. They went crazy. They built their own scroll bars. They built their own resized layouts, splitters, all kinds of stuff that already come in the browser, or at least are very easy to do with a sprinkling of JavaScript and existing elements in the browser. So we didn't want to go that far. We just wanted a robust editor that, you know, blows the editor in VisualWorks out of the water.
Well, you're aiming a little low there, but go on.
Yeah, and was multilingual, so that it wasn't just small talk. So any grammar that we can...
Now, that's a question that came up earlier today. I was talking to our product manager, Arden Thomas, and he asked me the question as to what grammars the system would parse when 1.1 came out. So what's the answer to that question?
Smalltalk, JavaScript, CSS, and PEG.
Okay.
And PEG is the grammar we use for defining grammars. So all of those grammars that I just said are written in PEG.
Okay, so that means that you could define your own grammar also. If for some reason you wanted to write Lisp or Python in WebVelocity, you could go ahead and define that.
Right, it's practically pluggable. I say practically pluggable because there are a couple of spots that... Actually, they might use Pragnus by now. It might be fully pluggable at this point, but you still have to go and create a bunch of infrastructure work to support it, feeding the search engine and creating the color highlighter, creating the colors for that highlighter, creating a compiler if you wanted to compile, that sort of stuff. So it's not a straightforward job, but
it's at least possible.
Yeah, more so than it ever has been for VisualWorks.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, you don't. It's not the sort of thing that just anyone's going to do. But then again, not just anyone is going to write a parser for a language anyway. I mean, certainly, I'm not going to take that job on.
Right. So there is, you know, object is sort of the concrete Smalltalk thing class that you usually subclass off. Sometimes you subclass off nil, but those are very special cases. Well, we've got JavaScript class and Stylesheet class, and there are some others, but the rest don't really matter that much. But those two do matter in web programming. You can make subclasses off, and you're writing in those languages, and it does its best to kind of help in that environment. We're going to obviously do more down the road.
Well, let me stop you right there for a sec, because this is interesting here on the JavaScript side. And when I wrote the media search application in WebVelocity 1.0 to get JavaScript action on my application, and I was using MooTools because that's what you were recommending then. And as an aside, I think everything's now jQuery instead of MooTools, right?
Yeah, underneath, absolutely everything's jQuery in the development tools now.
Okay, so leaving that aside for just a minute. When I was using JavaScript, I was doing it kind of the seaside way of having a file library that had to be loaded in. So are you telling me that in 1.1, you can that whole thing is abstracted, you can derive JavaScript classes and just use them?
Yes-ish. You still need to output it as a file library.
Okay.
But that's just, you create a file library, you make a method on there which calls the JavaScript method on your JavaScript class. And because the class side is Smalltalk, the instance side is JavaScript, because there are no classes in JavaScript.
Right.
So you send the Smalltalk method JavaScript to the JavaScript class you created, and you get back the JavaScript for that class. You can just actually include one file library that aggregates it all together, and include that on your page and put all that stuff.
So basically, you can create JavaScript objects and then message them the same way you would message any other Smalltalk object.
No. This is for client code. So imagine you're writing in two programming languages in the WebVelocity environment.
Yes.
You're writing in Smalltalk for your server application and JavaScript for your client application. So, you know, if you want to create a new widget that uses, say, the HTML canvas, HTML5 canvas, then you need to write some JavaScript. So you can do that in the same development environment as a subclass of the JavaScript class, and be able to output that to the client in your application. If you want to communicate between the client and the server from the JavaScript, what you can do is we have a thing called the conduit, which is just a fancy name to basically say, you know, like a conduit for wires, it's a conduit for messages. You, on the server side in your Smalltalk code, you create a conduit and you can put on the conduit functions and properties. And functions are blocks. And they turn into functions of the key name on the client side in JavaScript. And the properties is a key dictionary, and the keys become properties on the JavaScript object on the client side. Calling messages to that object can then call back to the server.
Okay, well, that still sounds simpler than it was in 1.0. 1.0, it seemed to me like it was a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, sure, probably.
Now a short interlude for this week's Squeak News with Randall Schwartz.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. The Workshop on Self-Sustaining Systems, also known as S3, is a forum for discussion of topics relating to computer systems and languages that are able to bootstrap, implement, modify, and maintain themselves. One property of these systems is that their implementation is based on small but powerful abstractions. Examples include, amongst others, Squeak and Smalltalk, Cola, Clean Self, PyPy and Python, Rubinius and Ruby, and Lisp. Such systems are the engines of their own replacement, giving researchers and developers great power to experiment with and explore future directions from within their own small language kernels. S3 will take place September 27-28, 2010, at the University of Tokyo in Japan. It is an exciting opportunity for researchers and practitioners interested in self-sustaining systems to meet and share their knowledge, experience, and ideas for future research and development. See the conference website for details and deadlines. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my Smalltalk-related blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast. Not to mention the fact that jQuery, I should jump back to that since that's a new feature of 1.1 also. Seaside 3 and 2.9 before it, they were moving much more heavily into jQuery as opposed to in Seaside terms, they had never gone to MooTools. I mean, you built that for Web Velocity, but they had been using Scriptaculous and underneath that prototype, and they've moved very heavily to supporting jQuery since jQuery seems to be what pretty much everybody doing JavaScript development there's kind of a consensus that it's the best JavaScript library out there right now. Is that a fair statement, you think?
Yep. The reason we were using MooTools is because it supported our development process. It allowed us to write JavaScript classes. But as we started doing the parser work, we needed to be able to do syntax color highlighting on the client. And profiling that, making that run fast, we discovered that a chunk of the time was actually spent inside this wrapper method for MooTools that was around every single method that was on a class. And it was there so that it could set up some meta properties in your method while your method was running and then tear them down when you come out of your method. And one of the meta properties was the ability to call a super method. This is really kind of useful, but at the same time, we never used it. So
that's one of those things you thought would be more useful than it actually was.
Yeah. So where MooTools had this focus on being modular and having classes, very cool. I love it. The rest of it didn't really compete well with jQuery. So jQuery makes all of the other stuff that you tend to want to do on the client, which is animations and Ajax communication and all that kind of stuff. It does that so much better than any of the other libraries. So we just implemented the ability to make classes ourselves, and we skipped that meta information so that it runs fast. You know, you don't need the meta information to call super if you really want to call super. There are ways to do it. Commented, documented somewhere. I can't remember where exactly, but you could do it. So, and yet we haven't done it once. Our class hierarchies are very shallow at this point, and we haven't needed to call super at all. So that basically, if we're making our own classes and jQuery provides everything else better, there was no real good reason to stay on MooTools anymore.
Especially since, as I said, it seems like the consensus in the industry has been that jQuery is the way to go. And it's also, just from the small talk standpoint, it's the way the Seaside community seems to have moved as well. They've moved along with everybody else.
Yes.
Yeah, and I remember last year at ESUG, I took the Seaside tutorial that Julian, and I think it was Philippe Marchal were giving. Or no, it was Lucas and Philippe Marchal, I'm sorry. There was those two. In any case, I took that tutorial, and it was, well, maybe I'm wrong. I don't remember who gave it now. It's too long ago, and that was anyway.
It was in a different language.
It was in a different language. That's my excuse, yes. So thank you for providing an excuse that isn't valid, but I'll use it anyway. In any case, when I took that tutorial, I remember that using jQuery seemed very, very simple and straightforward, because when I did the media search application, while MooTools was relatively easy to use, it still was a little trickier. I just got the impression in that tutorial that jQuery was really, really straightforward.
Okay, so you're editing code in Smalltalk, and you want to know who implements a message and who sends this message, and or even who references this class. They're all very, very common search things that you do in Smalltalk all the time.
Yeah,
uh-huh. As you're doing your programming in Web Velocity, those searches just happen in the background on the right-hand side of the screen very quickly because they're using Searchlight.
So that's so Searchlight is hooked up as a context-aware thing that as you're writing code, it'll show you things that you might be interested in searching on.
Right. I mean, if I've got a method up and I click on a selector inside the method, bam, on the right-hand side, up come the implementers of that message straight away.
And that's cool. That's not happening. The way it happens in VisualWorks is you either get a new window or various people have written things that replace the contents of the window you're in. Neither way, it's kind of a context-shifting kind of activity where your view is taken away to something else. This is happening kind of in the same viewport, if you will.
Well, you also got to remember that you have a back button in the web browser. So if you click on something, get a search result, click on the search result, then you decide it's not what you wanted, you just hit back.
But that's not the way this works. This is over on the right-hand side, kind of in a pane, right?
No, I'm saying that that's exactly how it works. If you click on something, search results.
The search results. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I gotcha.
Right. So, and you can middle click or control click or whatever combination you use to open it up in a new tab or a new window as well. So it's not like you're limited to just having one window. You actually can embrace the browser's multiple tab mode as a development thing. And I actually do that all the time. I often have two or three development tabs open and the final output tab of my application. So I can just change some code, swap back the tab, and hit refresh and see how it looks.
Right, and what that tells me is that this is something that we started in WebVelocity 1.0 and has really continued in 1.1, is that instead of trying to force fit a Smalltalk mode of thinking on top of the web browser, what you've done here is tried to embrace the way the web browser is presenting stuff and gotten the Smalltalk stuff to adapt to it rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is very different from the way Smalltalkers have traditionally looked at things. I mean, traditionally, every time we've seen a square peg, we've taken or a square hole, we've taken the round peg and hammered it until it went in.
Yes, how can we make the web browser work exactly like the existing Smalltalk
Yeah, that would have been the classic Smalltalk approach, yes.
We have a kind of not really a workspace, but sort of like a workspace in the right-hand side as well, which we call a console. And you basically just write some small talk code in there. It's already context sensitive, which is interesting. And you can write some small talk code in there, and it will print out the result as a part of an inspector underneath the console. So you actually get sticky objects in your console that you can move from screen to screen. And when you don't care about them anymore, you just hit the little X and they go away.
So that gives you that exploratory development mode that a lot of us are used to doing in Smalltalk, where you just, instead of committing, it's not that it's much of a commitment, but instead of committing to a full class and a bunch of methods, it's quite common in Smalltalk to just start stringing some workspace code together until you get to the point where you feel like you have some concept of what it is you're doing.
Yeah, in essence. So what else have we got there? We obviously got the documentation, which is a big part. The debugging in CSIDE 3.0 is different. In CSIDE 2.8, when something broke, you popped up in a debugger immediately. And that is not... The way that was done was incredibly hacky. both in terms of what CSIDE was doing and what we were doing. CSIDE cleaned up their act, and as a result, what we were doing could no longer work. So we've got a much simpler model now, which has some interesting side effects. If you're requesting a page, which means you're clicking on an action or loading a page, either in the development environment or in your own application, anywhere. If it breaks, the browser will just sit there and continue to load. If you bring up another WebVelocity window, in the processes list, you'll see a process drawn in red. Sorry if you're colorblind, but there are other ways to notice. And clicking on that will bring up in a debugger. And you can fix it and resume, and then the other browser window, which was loading, will complete.
Okay, so this is somewhat analogous to the way things have classically worked if you deployed a headless application, where if you took that headless application and you were able to say, and it ran into an exception, it would typically save out a file called headlessdebug.im. And then if you downloaded that, you could then start it up in a sort of save process list would be your blown process that you could then debug. But this goes one step better in that it doesn't quit. It just, you've got that as a hung process somewhere that you can go into that screen you just mentioned and you can start debugging it.
Right, and the entire thing gets logged out as well, which is also incredibly useful if this stuff happens while you're not looking. The debugger is as responsive as it was before. Of course, it's got the new tools plugged into it, so it's even better. And I guess that's it. There have been lots of minor improvements all over the place as well. Lots of menu enhancements, lots of dialogue enhancements. I know, have you used it lately, James?
Well, I used the last build you sent me a little bit, and I ran into some problems like I mentioned to you, and Arden has mentioned a few problems as well. One of the things I was planning to do was to take the media search application that's deployed, and once we get into the beta stage, I was going to tackle rewriting that using jQuery in 1.1 and see how that goes. So I'll probably have a lot more to say about it once we get to that point. So I was going to rewrite that application and see how it worked out. In the meantime, I guess the thing I wanted to mention is that since we're getting close to the beta phase, that means we'll probably be getting this stuff into the hands of other people and trying to get some feedback that way.
Yeah, we're literally a week or two away from a beta.
Yeah, and I guess you'll see probably something on the website, and Arden Thomas will probably have some kind of announcement about that. But we're pretty close to being able to get other people's hands on this so that we can get some feedback from a wider circle than we've gotten so far. So far, the feedback's been mostly internal, and the people that Julian Fitzell has exposed this to, but we're going to try to widen that circle in a little bit. In the meantime, if you are interested, I suppose you should send an email either to Arden or myself and say that you're interested, and we'll see what we can do. The other question I wanted to ask you, Michael, is since there have been so many changes from 1.0 to 1.1, when can we expect to see some more of those screencasts, the longer form ones that you like to do about on Velocity 1.1?
Actually, good question, because I have done little teasers of the editor from time to time, because it consumed so much of the development effort for 1.1. But now we're kind of getting to the point where the whole of the story is all come together. So I guess I should try and do a screencast showing you how to use the environment probably sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And once you do that, obviously I'll point to it. So I guess that pretty much wraps up what we wanted to cover in this podcast. Did you have anything else you wanted to say about what's going on with 1.1, or should people just wait for an announcement at this point?
I think you really have to kind of see it to believe it. It's a pretty huge jump in terms of capability. And I expect from here on out, it's just going to keep going uphill.
All right. Well, it sounds good. Not that you're not on the podcast every week anyway, but thanks for agreeing to talk about this on this podcast. And
yes, I was interviewed this time instead of interviewing.
Yeah. I had to wear that the interviewee hat when we talked about Bottom Feeder a few weeks ago, so I guess we had to put the hat on the other shoe or something.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more small talkers and more developers learning about small talk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Small Talkers group, or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Small Talk.